Politics aside, being a woman is hard. When it comes to our ever-changing menstrual cycle, perimenopause, or menopause, we could use support, and that's where Happy Mammoth comes in. Remember that awful week before your period where you feel off and look in the mirror and don't recognize your reflection and you want to crawl out of your own skin? I don't. Estro Control by Happy Mammoth has made managing PMS symptoms so much easier. And for my friends who are going through menopause or perimenopause, or even if you've come out the other side and still feel like a wet sock on a busy highway, Hormone Harmony is a lifesaver. It's not just me saying this, it's become a phenomenon. Women can't stop talking about it on social media, and a bottle is sold every 24 seconds. The secret? Happy Mammoth uses only science-backed ingredients, including adaptogens, which help your body adapt to the stressors of hormonal changes. It's not just for menopause either. Any woman with hormonal imbalances can benefit. Imagine getting relief from hot flashes, night sweats, low moods, and poor sleep. And the best part, feeling like yourself again. With over 17,000 reviews, this isn't just hype. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code RAIN at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use code RAIN for 15% off. It's never been easy for me to serve delicious, wholesome, homemade meals that are budget-friendly and kid-approved. At least, not until now. Gobble, my favorite meal prep kit, makes it so easy. All Gobble meal kits are designed by professional chefs and are pre-prepped. That means less work for you and less waste in your kitchen. Gobble meals include gourmet, chef-made ingredients that make cooking a breeze, from signature sauces and unique spice blends to compound butters, marinades, and reductions. With a huge range of weekly meals, Gobble makes it easy for families of all tastes and sizes to build a menu everyone will love. Childhood favorites, trending ingredients, and bold new flavors. There's always something to discover, so dinner is never boring. One of my favorite things is I can easily switch up my menu. Some days we go for family favorites, other days I'm on my own and can order lean and clean meals to ensure I hit my nutritional goals. Personally, I find Gobble to be so refreshing for a number of reasons. I'm a single mom with a teenage daughter, and we're not only trying to save money, but also reduce food waste, and she's learning how to cook. I don't want to send her off to college without the skills to feed herself, so Gobble has been the perfect way to learn new recipes and have her cook them herself. Not to mention, we have the perfect amount of ingredients for two meals, so we aren't wasting money by throwing out leftovers or buying more ingredients than we need.
See what a difference Gobble will make for your household. Right now, they're offering our listeners a fantastic limited-time deal. Get $120 off across four boxes, plus free shipping and free cookies. Just go to gobble.com/therain. That's gobble.com/therain today. This offer is not available on their home site, so do not miss out. True Crime Fest Northwest is just a few weeks away, and you can get your tickets now at truecrimefestnorthwest.com. What can you expect from the inaugural event? On Friday, August 30th, attendees can check out the Expo Hall before enjoying a kickoff presentation and self-defense training from Rose City Self-Defense. On Saturday, you'll have another chance to get swag from your favorite podcasters and true crime creators in the Expo Hall. Presentations on Saturday include, but are not limited to, Desiree Young, who is Kyron Horman's mother, United Justice Group, which is family members of victims of accused serial killer Jesse Calhoun, our friends Sisters in Survival, a.k.a. Tiffany Edens and Danielle Tudor, the National Center for Victims of Crime, authors Lindsay Wade and Rebecca Morris, and some of your favorite podcasts like PNW Haunts and Homicides, A Hateful Homicide, Somewhere in the Pines, Snake River Killer, and of course, Murder in the Rain, among others. And those are just some of the scheduled appearances. Saturday night will also be the time for the VIP party. Sunday, the festivities continue with presentations, a drag bingo raffle fundraiser, and a VIP brunch. So get to truecrimefestnorthwest.com, use code RAIN10 for 10% off, and get your tickets today. And vendors, there's still time to sign up for a table. Visit TrueCrimeFestNorthwest.com and get your tickets now.
True Crime Fest Northwest.
This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
I may have mentioned this before, but I've spent the vast majority of my life living in Oregon. I only spent 2 years living outside of it, both of which were in Washington. The year after I graduated college, I lived in West Seattle while I tried my hand at an office job in the real estate world and attempted to figure out what grad school to apply to. I also spent a single year in high school, my sophomore year, when I decided to live with my dad. Him and my stepmom built their own house in a heavily forested area on the outskirts of Gig Harbor, Washington. Gig Harbor is the quintessential, picturesque little tourist trap. Located on the Puget Sound in the northwest portion of the state, it's known as the Maritime City because the city is built around a beautiful harbor filled with boats, tasty restaurants, and an endless number of cute shops that sell art and knickknacks. Driving by the harbor and through the very lush and green outskirts of the city, you would have a hard time envisioning that this would be a place wrought with any nefarious activity. So I was shocked when I learned that the path my dad would drive me to school each day would go right by a women's prison. Now, at the time, I didn't really think much about it, other than I knew Mary Kay Letourneau, the infamous sex offender teacher who was sentenced to prison for 2 counts of second-degree child rape for her lurid relationship with 12-year-old Vili Falau, was a resident at that prison, one who was recently returned to prison after violating her no-contact order with the child. And if you don't know much about that case, she ended up marrying him and having multiple children with him and legally separating from him in 2019. She then passed away due to colorectal cancer in the summer of 2020, with him by her side. The Washington Correctional Center for Women in Gig Harbor is the largest women's prison in Washington state with a capacity of 740 inmates. It's been functioning since 1971 and is known for its education and vocation programs. But many of us know about this prison due to the roster. In fact, I've personally covered several cases of some of their most notable inmates. These include Michelle Kristen Anderson, who is featured in one of our early episodes from 2019, episode 20, Kissing Wounds. Donna Perry, who is a serial killer I mentioned in episode 11, Homeboy Wrote Camaro. Donna underwent gender-affirming surgery in 2000, which became a huge topic at her trial. And let's not forget the monster mom herself, Shelley Nodick, who was featured in episode 36, Wallowing, The Stuff of Nightmares. As I recently considered my odd ties to this prison, it had me thinking about Mother's Day. That might sound odd, but with an upwards of 740 female prisoners, there are a lot of mothers spending their daily lives and their annual Mother's Day behind those bars. Many psychologists have been saying for years that there is essentially no more impactful experience than becoming a mother. This is essentially a total transformation that encompasses a person's entire being, from their brain chemistry to changes in their body. To quote a journal article called The Birth of a Mother, the transformation from woman to mother is a psychologically profound experience that both overlaps and is separate from the physical experience of becoming a mother. Oftentimes, a mother is compared to a hero because they provide what psychologists identified as 4 important functions of a hero: wisdom and intelligence, a model for moral behavior, they promote enhancement and inspiration, and defense and protection. In a 2016 study published in Nature Neuroscience, it was found that the brains of a person who gives birth seem to shrink in some areas, and it lasts for 2 years. Now, this isn't a loss of function, but results in changes to the neural connections, and it's thought to help with the transition into motherhood and may even allow them to prepare to protect their baby. The changes to the brain may only persist for 2 years, but in my experience, the willingness and obligation to protect one's children never leaves, at least for most people. In this week's Murder in the Rain episode, we'll discuss a case with a complicated list of players. When the body of a 33-year-old father is discovered in the brush off a residential road in Gig Harbor, Washington, an unlikely list of suspects is developed, and you'll end up asking yourself, where is the line when protecting someone you love? Would you lie in court for a friend, for your brother, for your child? Would you lie for your mother? Just how far does a mother's love go? On July 12, 2012, at around 8:30 p.m., a 911 call was made in Gig Harbor, Washington. In the call, a man described that he and his wife were walking their dog when their dog wandered into the brush and couldn't be recalled. When they walked into the somewhat marshy area just off the road, they discovered what their dog had been investigating. There, they found a dead body. The caller described that the body was that of a black male, and he suggested that the man may have been hit by a car, as he was found just mere feet from the road. When investigators arrived, it was quickly determined that this wasn't a hit-and-run death. It was definitely a homicide. The body had been there for at least a few hours, and the man had white duct tape covering his ankles, his wrists, his mouth, and his eyes. Stretching out near the body along the ground were drag marks, indicating that the man had been murdered in another location and dragged from the road into the spot where his body was found. The crime scene was quickly taped off so investigators could scour the location for any clues indicating what might have happened, who the man was, or who committed the crime. Unfortunately, there wasn't a whole lot to help them with the investigation. They did find a few packing peanuts as well as some Dora the Explorer cards, essentially a small cardboard cutout of Dora. Crime scene techs collected the items, not knowing if it was trash or evidence. The body was taken for autopsy, and it was determined that he had died due to a single gunshot wound to his back. Because of the placement on his upper back and angle, it was thought that the gunshot likely occurred during some kind of altercation. The time of death lined up to what investigators initially thought. It was likely just under a day. The medical examiner thought it would have happened between the late night hours of July 11th and the early morning hours of July 12th. The man's wallet had been located in the brush near where his body was found, and the ID and credit cards inside identified him as 33-year-old Leon Dwayne Bauckham Jr. Leon was born on December 22, 1978, to parents Leon Sr. and LaVon Bauckham of Tacoma, Washington. He was the eldest of five children. As a kid, he was a huge fan of football and even played tackle positions. When Leon became an adult, he worked at Boeing and Northwest Cascade. His family described him as hardworking, intelligent, and committed. At the age of 23, Leon met 21-year-old Waimiko Roberts. The pair hit it off and quickly decided early on that they wanted to settle down together. Waimiko brought her son Brandon into the relationship, and Leon easily stepped into being a father figure. The pair was married on August 16, 2008, and within a few years, they added two more children to their family, Ava and Elijah. Waimiko's main job was to care for the children, but eventually she was eager to rejoin the workforce and to help provide for their family. She ended up getting a job at a local cable company. Unfortunately, her job would play a role in how their relationship would change over time, and that would also factor into Leon's murder. After discovering Leon's body, detectives went to do the part of their job that none of them enjoyed, notifying Leon's family of his death. When they went to the home listed on his license, they met his wife, Waimiko. After receiving the news, Waimiko was understandably distraught. She eventually collected herself and began calling all of her family to relay the devastating news. She was easily able to get a hold of her husband's family. However, she struggled to get a hold of her own mother, who was vacationing about 200 miles away at Moses Lake. Waimiko and her mother were incredibly close. In fact, her mother, Jackie Ray, helped her raise her son until Leon came into their lives. She needed her mother's support now more than ever with the loss of her husband. Unfortunately, Jackie couldn't rush back due to a storm, and Waimika was left on her own until she could arrive. Though the family had just been struck with news of the tragedy, detectives needed to find a lead. They began talking to Waimika to understand as much as possible about the people in Leon's life, as well as anything going on that could help illuminate what might have happened to him. They quickly learned key information. For the past few months, Waimika and Leon were having marital problems. Leon was, as Waimika would describe, jealous and controlling. This got worse when she went back to work. The people in their lives described Waimika as incredibly beautiful, which she absolutely is, but some in his family would say she chose to dress provocatively to go to work, which they said Leon didn't like. But who is a man to tell a woman how to dress? That being said, it's easy to understand how that would likely make a jealous man even more jealous. Eventually, his jealousy led to him installing a tracking app on her phone so that he could see her whereabouts at all times.
Uh-oh.
Leon had noticed that Waimika was being a little secretive about her phone. In her defense, I would too, but I wouldn't stand for someone installing a tracking app on my phone, which she was apparently aware of. She had been hiding text messages and overall acting suspicious. This made Leon worry that she may have been having an affair. His suspicions were confirmed when a friend of his called him. This friend worked at the same cable company as Waimika, and he suggested to Leon that he should come down there and confront a man that Waimika had been cheating on him with. Now, he did this, and the confrontation quickly escalated. After he approached the man at her work, they went home, and the fight between them continued. On May 30th, 2012, this only got worse, when he took her phone and read some sexual messages that the man had sent her. Before long, their fight went from verbal to physical, and Leon hit Waimika. The strike to Waimika's face resulted in a fractured eye socket, and her mother, Jackie, called the police to make a domestic violence report. When there is a domestic dispute such as this one, it is standard procedure in Washington state to issue an emergency no-contact order if one of the parties is in extreme risk. And that's what happened in this situation. A court decided Leon was not allowed to be in contact with his wife, Waimika. He would need to leave their home and stay elsewhere until the situation was resolved. After some initial time apart, the couple decided to continue to work on things, which meant breaking the no-contact order to be with each other. To outside parties, it would appear that Leon was staying with his grandmother, when in actuality, he was spending many nights at home with his wife and children. Leon had expressed that he wanted to change and wanted to be with his family, but according to some of Waimika's family members, over the course of a few weeks, he went from wanting to change to be better to growing more and more jealous, controlling, and erratic. This resulted in another fight. When Waimika told her mother about their disagreement and his behavior, Jackie urged her to take some space. Waimika decided to take the children and check into the Comfort Inn in Federal Way on July 11th. That way, she wouldn't be in the house if Leon wanted to engage in more fighting and she could have space to think about her next steps. We are well aware that in a murder investigation, detectives start by looking into the people closest to the victim because, well, statistics. According to Statista.com, looking at solved murders in 2022, the majority of people killed were killed by an acquaintance. So that's why their ears perked right up when a couple of red flags were raised while they interviewed Leon's family. Investigators were fairly certain that Leon knew his murderer, and this was because of his SUV. Due to the recent incident that required a no-contact order between Leon and Waimika, Leon had been staying with his grandmother on and off. He was trying to work things out with her and had been staying at their house on occasion, but the pair was worried that being caught breaking the order could result in Leon's arrest. After their fight, Waimika wanted some space, and on July 11th, Leon had spoken with his grandmother and she fully expected him to be at her home that night. She told police that he never came home the night of July 11th, and when she got up the next day and went outside, his white SUV wasn't in his parking spot. She went about her day on July 12th, and when she returned home, his white SUV was parked in his spot, yet he was nowhere to be found. According to his autopsy, he would have already been dead when the car ended up in his parking space, leading investigators to believe that the murderer was the one who parked the car in the space. You might say, well, they could have checked his ID and found the location. Solid reasoning, but the address listed on his ID was his home with his wife, Waimika. So either this person would have had to have followed him from his grandmother's home prior to the murder, they coaxed the address out of him when they killed him, or they knew where it was already. Using Occam's razor, I think we can deduce which scenario is more likely. During their interview with Waimika, not once did she ask how her husband had died or where his body had been found. It's pretty common to ask those two questions when you're told your partner has been murdered. On the other hand, I suppose I would expect that information would be relayed to me without having to ask. Also, we talk about it a lot. You just don't know how a person is going to react to this kind of information. Multiple people said Waimika was incredibly distraught, and distraught people don't always think logically or predictably.
Especially since they have that order and they're concerned about the police finding out. She might also be thinking about that because your brain does unexpected things. So she could be worried about getting herself in trouble just based off of that.
And it was the wee hours of the morning. We're talking 3 a.m. Cops are in your house telling you your husband was found dead. I don't think you have a list of questions prepared for that.
Right. Yeah.
But it's from a detective's point of view, they're having to look at every angle when they don't have a lead. You know, families always looked at first. Whether her reaction is what they expected or not, investigators did their job and looked into her whereabouts. According to both Waimika and her mother, Jackie, Waimika was staying in a motel in Federal Way with her children. When she notified her mother about her most recent fight with Leon, her mother was the one who helped her get checked into the hotel before going on her getaway with her husband, Nathaniel, in Moses Lake. When investigators spoke to the motel workers, they all confirmed that Waimika was indeed staying there the night of July 11th. She then returned home on July 12th, and that's why she was there when police arrived to tell her her husband was dead. Now, just because she was there doesn't mean she didn't have any involvement, but they were confident she wasn't in the vicinity during the time of the murder. It wasn't until police started digging into official records when they got a hot lead. The constant fighting between Waimika and Leon seemed like a flashing neon sign. So they began looking into the only official record of domestic violence between the couple, the one initiated by Waimika's mother, Jackie, 2 months prior to the murder. As they began reviewing the records of the incident that resulted in Waimika's fractured eye socket, they saw an address listed in the document that was very familiar. When police arrested Leon for the domestic violence incident, the arrest didn't happen at Leon and Waimika's Puyallup residence. It took place in Jackie Ray's home, a Gig Harbor address just under a mile from where Leon's body was discovered. All of this information thrust Waimika's mother, Jackie, into the spotlight, and detectives started looking into her whereabouts during the murder. As I mentioned, Jackie and her husband, Nathaniel, had been vacationing at Moses Lake, which was roughly 200 miles away. That trip started on July 10th. However, they learned that the couple had driven separately. Jackie claimed that this was due to some errands she needed to run before she left to meet Nathaniel. She had intended to leave July 11th after the errands, but got delayed due to Waimika calling her regarding the most recent fight with Leon. So instead of leaving for her trip, she got Waimika a hotel room for the night in Federal Way. She told police she paid for the room, went home and stayed the night, and eventually drove out to the lake on July 12th. This meant she was home the night of July 11th and didn't have an alibi for the time of the murder.
That's not good.
Alicia is a big proponent of being a tattletale. And in fact, a lot of the cases we cover have a big break due to someone seeing something and saying something.
We aren't tattlers. We're heroes.
So we definitely support a little bit of tattling around here. And in Leon's murder, a witness came forward to help build an even stronger case. Ron Pratt, a good friend of Leon, called police during the investigation to share information he had. According to Rob, on the night of July 11th, the night Leon was murdered, Leon had called him. This was one of, if not the last call Leon had with anyone. During their conversation, Leon told Ron that his reconciliation wasn't going exactly as planned, and he and Waimiko had another fight, and she had left him and wasn't answering any of his calls. However, he had hoped to fix that, because according to his mother-in-law, Jackie, who had called him at around 10:30 p.m., Waimiko was open to speaking with him in person at Jackie's house in Gig Harbor. He told his friend that he was on his way to his mother-in-law's house, and that was just before midnight and possibly moments before his murder. As you know, detectives were aware that there was a tracking app installed on Waimiko's phone. Their assumption was that Leon would check the app to ensure Waimiko was at the house before coming over. They are confident that that was the case. They subpoenaed Waimiko's phone records and confirmed a number of things. Firstly, she was having an affair with a coworker for some time. She had been speaking to that man up through the day of the murder. Secondly, her phone pinged the night of July 11th on a tower near Jackie's home. So either Waimiko was at Jackie's house waiting for Leon to come over, or Jackie had Waimiko's phone because she knew Leon wouldn't come over without verifying that Waimiko was there.
That's pretty devious.
It's very devious. That's planned, right? Detectives were sure that Waimiko was at the hotel that night, which means Jackie was likely luring Leon into her home that night. Armed with this newly discovered information, detectives subpoenaed Jackie's phone records and worked to secure a search warrant for her home and vehicle. Though police were now positive Jackie was involved, they didn't think she could have done it alone. They eliminated her daughter Waimiko, who was at the hotel that night. They eliminated Jackie's husband, Nathaniel, because he was 200 miles away in Moses Lake. They even eliminated Waimiko's lover, as he was at a movie during the time of the murder. Jackie wouldn't have been able to move a man of Leon's size herself. In fact, even with a gun, she was unlikely to take him down herself. Lucky for them, her phone records confirmed what detectives theorized, that Jackie was involved and she had a bit of help. Text messages found on her phone prior to the murder revealed that she was texting someone about Leon being on his way to her house and she wanted this person to come over ASAP. The person on the other end texted her back that he was on his way over. Unfortunately, there wasn't a name associated with the text, so police requested that information from the phone company. While they waited for that vital information, they continued to uncover evidence of Jackie's involvement. Once the detective search warrant was approved, they headed over to search her home, her property, and her vehicle. The inside and outside of the Ray home didn't reveal anything of particular importance. However, inside her car was another story. There they found a box, and inside that box were packing peanuts that looked exactly like the ones found at the crime scene. And if that wasn't enough, there were several Dora the Explorer cards found on the vehicle floor. Now they had a strong case, and detectives confronted Jackie with what they knew, her whereabouts and lack of alibi, the text with the unknown man, and now the evidence found in her car. They were taken aback when, instead of denying any involvement, she confirmed it. According to Jackie, she never pulled the trigger, but she had been involved. She had a connection who was freshly out of prison. Now, I'm not sure how Jackie knew this person, but in what she considered a great time of need for herself and her family, she turned to a man named Luis. Luis Rhea Barker was 37 years old and freshly out of prison, or as I like to call it, the clink. Luis's criminal record dates back to before 2004, and it includes reckless driving, robbery, unlawful possession of a firearm, multiple violations for what I imagine are for parole, quite a few offenses for drug possession and delivery, assault, and controlled substance violations. Jackie described to investigators that when she felt like there was no other way to help, she reached out to Luis to help her problem go away. The pair made a deal. In exchange for $10,000, Luis would kill her daughter's abuser, her husband, Leon. She claimed she was desperate. She feared for her daughter's life. Not only had Leon attacked her, resulting in the restraining order, he had been threatening her as well. Jackie told them about how when she was married to Waimiko's father, Richard Roberts, he was abusive towards her. She was able to leave that marriage and move on and eventually marry her current husband, Nathaniel. However, Waimiko's father would be abusive towards his new wife, Elizabeth. Unfortunately, this resulted in a murder-suicide. Waimiko's father would go on to kill his wife, Elizabeth, and then turn the gun on himself. Jackie said that the real tipping point for her and Waimiko's situation was that Leon used this information to intimidate Waimiko. Apparently, Waimiko had shared with Jackie that Leon was threatening her and essentially told her that they would end up in the same situation as her father.
Whoa.
That's when Jackie decided to act. She obtained $8,000 out of her bank account and paid Luis as a down payment to take care of their problem. On the night of July 11th, 2012, Jackie helped check Waimiko into the Comfort Inn in Federal Way, where she would stay with her children. Jackie then took Waimiko's phone with her, the one that was being tracked by Leon. She called her son-in-law that night and told him Waimiko was willing to speak to him, but only if it were at Jackie's home. As she had Waimiko's phone, if Leon checked to be sure that she was in the location, it would appear that she was. When Leon arrived at the Ray residence around midnight, two men were lying in wait, Luis and a friend he brought along to help with the job. Once he stepped inside, the men began intimidating Leon before moving to beat him up. At that point, Jackie left the room as she didn't want to hear what happened to her son-in-law. While she was in the other room, she said she heard a scuffle and then a gunshot. After the shot rang out, she could hear Leon pleading and promising that he would leave Waimiko alone. Now that, she said, wasn't the original plan. They were to take Leon out of her house before killing him, but it didn't go according to their plan. Luis then approached Jackie asking for duct tape and plastic so that they could get rid of Leon's, at that point, still breathing body. Jackie brought them the requested supplies and they began to tape Leon's body and cover him in plastic. They moved him into Jackie's car and left to dump the body. After they dumped his body, they returned. Jackie drove Leon's car to his grandmother's house the next day to leave it where it would later be found. Jackie was arrested for first-degree murder as an accomplice and first-degree felony murder as an accomplice. As investigators anticipated, this was a multi-person job and they wanted to capture everyone who was responsible. This led to a deal. In exchange for helping them arrest Luis, Jackie could nab herself a reduced sentence. She agreed to it, of course. A plea deal was struck and she would get a reduced charge of second-degree murder if she admitted to aiding in the assault of Leon Bockham and could get Luis to admit to what he did on recording. So she was taped up with a wiretap and met Luis for lunch. She initiated the conversation by asking him why he shot Leon in her house, as it wasn't part of the plan. He replied that he didn't want to and the plan was to beat him up, take him out of the house and kill him outside, but they didn't anticipate him fighting back so much, so the plan had to change in order to get the result that they wanted. That was enough to seal Luis's fate, and he was arrested on August 7, 2012. Luis Barker accepted a plea deal on October 29, 2013 for second-degree murder with a firearm enhancement. On November 15, he was sentenced to 34 years in prison. Luis is currently being held at the Stafford Creek Correctional Facility in Aberdeen, Washington. Similar to their conversation with Jackie, police were interested in this third person, the other guy. But Luis refused to turn on his friend and gave them nothing. Jackie didn't know the friend, so all she could provide to police was that he was a white male in his mid-20s and about average height. Later, in 2013, after the arrests of Jackie and Luis, a third arrest was finally made. A 23-year-old man named J.R. Leatherchild was arrested for a hit-and-run, illegal drug possession, and obstructing a police officer. While in custody, additional charges were filed against him for his involvement in Leon's murder. He was put in jail on a 72-hour hold and had a $1 million bail set. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find any additional information.
Really?
He doesn't seem to be in the prison system, and he's not on BIN verified, so I have to assume that that's not his legal name, and that maybe, you know, JR is like John Riley or something. Yeah. I don't know. So if anyone knows, let me know. Jacqueline Ray went to trial in 2014, and her legal team explained to the court that the reason she plotted and paid for the murder of her son-in-law was to protect her daughter and grandchildren from a chronically abusive man, one that her daughter claimed threatened to shoot her just like her own father did to his wife. Though they argued that he was regularly abusive, there was only a single incident that occurred in official criminal records. The domestic violence incident, which had a police report that led investigators to Ray's residence in the first place. Leon's family argued that he did not regularly abuse his wife. The one incident in question was due to his anger over her affair and was a moment of blind rage and weakness that wasn't regularly repeated. They believed Waimiko and her family were lying to try to get leniency for Jackie. Leon's family was adamant about this and pressed the court to hold Jackie to the maximum sentence of 25 years. Alternatively, Jackie's team asked for just 5 years, claiming she wasn't a risk and only did what she thought she had to protect her family because there was no other choice. Multiple people spoke on her behalf and reminded the court that she had spent decades helping people as a respiratory therapist, volunteering at Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. She even volunteered for the local search and rescue team and fed the homeless. In addition to pleas from her husband and even her reverend for leniency, her daughter Waimiko spoke on her behalf and described the constant abuse Leon inflicted on her. She described that her mother was a good person who was just trying to save her. She said, quote, "My mother is not an evil person. She was really trying to protect myself and my children. My mother did not do what she did because she had any hate or didn't want me to be with Leon." Though she didn't take the stand and talk openly about her motive, in the end, Jackie Ray expressed remorse, saying, quote, "It is my hope that my sentencing here today, with God's mercy, everyone would someday forgive me." While I couldn't validate the claim made by Waimiko regarding her biological father killing his new wife, I could see that they died around the same time. Her father, Richard, didn't have a criminal record. I was also able to pull records on Leon, and he did have several assaults on his record outside of the domestic violence assault used in their case. In the end, the judge did not grant the request of either side of the court. They went in between the request and sentenced Jackie to 18 years and 4 months in prison. With the sentence, the judge, Stanley Rumbaugh, said, quote, "Where was mercy when Leon Bockham lay dying on Jackie Ray's doorstep? There was no mercy for Leon Bockham." Jacqueline Ray now lives in the Washington Correction Center for Women in Gig Harbor, located on Bojasik Road, the very location I used to drive by every day and beg my dad not to roll down the window and make lewd comments.
That's kind of a tough one for me. Yeah. I'm not sure where I stand, because if you look at what's presented, I feel like if your daughter came to you and said, "My husband broke my eye socket," I know for me, it'd be hard to keep me away from them that moment and ripping them to shreds. Add to the fact that her ex-husband was violent and did what he did, your brain is thinking in a very different way than the average person. Mm-hmm. So I can totally see and really almost validate that choice she made. If you think your grandchild and your daughter are in danger.
Yeah, I it's one of those cases where you really can have empathy for the person who did the murdering. And I know people don't like to hear that, but you can see the humanity side of it. However, there are a million other things you could do than murder someone. You can go get help. You can put them in a shelter.
Use the $10,000 to move somewhere.
Yep.
Talk to him. Pay him off. Say, "I will give you $8,000 to never talk to them again."
It's a lot to go from zero to murder. And obviously we don't condone that. But I can see why someone might think that because of their trauma.
Which is not to take away from his family's experience.
Absolutely.
Which is the thing that happened to her that she's trying to prevent from happening then happened to him. So the pain and the destruction still happened just to his family.
On the other side of the coin, we only have one domestic violence charge.
Does that mean that much, though?
I'm just saying from their point of view, and if they're not witnessing him being violent on a regular basis, of course they're going to back him.
I guess from my lens, that doesn't mean anything because most things aren't reported. People are very different in front of their spouse than they are to their family.
Sure. But you definitely, in this situation, you have to prove something was done. While you have to prove she murdered him, are they proving that he is a repeatedly violent person?
I think I fall back on what would the other motive be?
Sure. Yeah. Would it be? She just didn't like him?
Yeah. This guy sucks. Or, I don't like that they're getting back together.
I think it's a clear motive. I think we can agree.
And even if it was the one incident, let's say that was a crime of passion. He's upset about the affair. He's never done that. He was this great guy and had never done anything. which is a totally feasible possibility, which also makes all of this that much more horrible. He still went so far that he broke a bone in her face.
And tracked her and was jealous.
And was tracking her. And then you have this history there. Mm-hmm. And so even if it's one side could say, oh, well, there was just the one thing. Well, for this mom, that one thing, that wasn't just the match being lit. That was the fuse being mm-hmm. lit.
And it's about the most dangerous situation you can be in.
Right.
Absolutely. For a woman, that is
exactly.
a common way they end up dead.
Like my sticker, home is where the murderer is, statistically.
I mean, yeah. So I do get it. It's just the average person isn't going to leap to pain someone to kill them.
Yeah.
First of all, you don't get away with that very often.
Right. And the one guy, he was a hitman. He was just doing it to get paid. That's pretty sick. But
he's also spent much of his life in prison.
Right.
And
so it's like, okay, that guy's super dangerous.
Yeah.
This mom isn't in a state of insanity, but a state of motherhood.
Even the detectives reflected on the case and basically were saying they were shocked. She's the nicest lady. Mm. You would never think that. But a mother will do what she thinks she needs to do to protect her children. It's just a little crazy what she did.
I'm not a mother and I certainly wouldn't murder anyone, but I can definitely understand that deep desire to see that person out of your life.
Well, I think most people in the moment you're seeing something you
or
could
just
commit
punished.
Murder.
Yeah, punished. Yeah.
But to plan it like that.
Yeah.
That's the devious factor. That's
right.
That premeditation, taking $8,000 of your account. Like, obviously, you're going to get caught.
Right.
Obviously.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I appreciate it. You know, I love a gray story because, yeah, you think of his family and think, oh, my God, that's horrific and horrible. And not just that he's dead, but to die such a horrible way and to be treated that way. And on the other side, yeah, she's that you're like Josh said, it's the most dangerous situation you could be in. And they know firsthand you have to act. Otherwise, they've seen the outcome. I'll be pondering on that a while.
I know. Tasty restaurants and an endless number of cute shops that sell... Jesus Christ. An endless number of cute shops that sell art and knickknacks. Oh my God! Why do I write these words for myself? This would be a place wrought with any nefarious activity.
Nefarious. Sorry, you're so fancy.
Oftentimes, a mother is compared to a hero because they provide...
Provide.
With my fancy accent. July 11th and the very early morning... What is wrong with me? I was on the phone for 7 hours today.
Ew.
Or not phone, Zoom calls, you know.
Ew.
So was Alicia talking timeshares with
a
robot.
Okay. I struggle to be rude. Unless I love you, then I'm an asshole.
Detectives went on to do their... Nope, not lies.
Hey. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed.
That felt so good.
I bet it did. You just wait for repayment.
I know.
That noise and response.
To relay the devastating news.
We do end up with great bloopers when we do night recordings.
I know, but I really want to get laid, so I gotta finish.
Yeah. I gotta finish so I can finish.
Yeah, exactly.
David Duchovny.
When investigators spoke to the motel.
Holiday Inn.
We all did it.
J.R. Leatherchild sounds like a werewolf hunter.
It does.
Yeah, that's one heck of a name.
It doesn't sound like a 23-year-old white guy at all. It sounds like someone out of a book I would read.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sort of young adult
book character
name.
Yeah.
Yes.
We
In
call
the Scorch Trials.
Leatherchild.
Jack.
Sorry. Go ahead. Classic Keith.
Classic Keith.
Classic blooper. I remember that.
Yep.
Yeah. Screaming, being like, you're never going to get this.
Yep. And now I just think of all the people in there that we've covered on our show who I would be scared to know where I lived.
I think it's extremely likely that your dad hung out at that prison and waited for a lady to come out and was like, what do you think?
You need a ride and 20 bucks?
No
way.
How
do you feel about balloons?
He definitely would give someone a ride when they got out. But...
Oh, I bet. I have a question about the witness or the guy that was a suspect for a while who went to the movies.
Oh, the lover.
That was the lover. Okay.
That was Waimiko's lover.
Was that in Gig Harbor?
The movie?
Yeah.
I think it may have been in Puyallup because that is where their home was. So I'm guessing she worked in the same city that she lived in, but I'm not sure. I didn't validate that.
All right. Well, if they were in Puyallup.
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 Puyallup. Yep.
Puyallup.
Very good.
He was either seeing, I just looked up the day of.
Oh, yay.
So in that place, he was either seeing Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, Magic Mike, The Avengers, Men in Black 3,
ooh,
Prometheus, wow. Rock of Ages, Savages, also yuck, Ted, or The Amazing Spider-Man.
Holy cow.
Or Tyler Perry's Madea's Witness Protection.
There are a lot of good choices there.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderintherain. And suck my balls.